Good morning, brothers and sisters. So far, the study of Ecclesiastes has been very profitable for us to consider. By this study, we hope we have gained some of the wisdom of God. We realize it was given to Solomon, and he left it for us in this book. Solomon had asked for an understanding heart to judge God's people, that he might discern between good and evil. 1 Kings 3 and 9. And God had given him wonderful skills in the judicial matters. But like Job, Solomon finally finds the true wisdom with Yahweh's help. He tells us, whatever wisdom may be, it is far off and most profound. Who can discover it? Ecclesiastes 9 in the NLV. With Paul too, we can only but marvel at the wisdom of the Lord. He says, oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments and His ways past finding out. Romans 11:33. In his final speech, Job came to the same conclusion as Solomon does at the end of Ecclesiastes. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. Job 28:28. With this in mind, let us turn our attention to chapter 9. Solomon continues to consider some of the problems of life, searching for answers to the problem that puzzled him. The chapter can be divided as follows. If you're looking at the Bible, verses 1 and 2 are the similarity of events of the lives of the righteous and the wicked. Verses 3 through 6 is a comparison between the dead and the living. Verses 7 through 10 is the successful living of in the shadow of death. Verses 11 through 12 is a warning of an uncertainty of life. And verses 13 through 18 is a parable of wisdom. In the first verse of chapter 9, we are told that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of Yahweh. In these comforting words, Solomon declares Yahweh's uncontested control over human activity. Though he could not understand all the details of Yahweh's dealing with the human race as a whole, he was certain of this one fact, that the righteous who knows Yahweh's will and does it are in his power. It is he who worketh them both to will and to do his good pleasure. His good pleasure is to bring about the kingdom. We are told in Proverbs 3:6, in all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. This does not mean only good will come to us. What we experience in this lifetime does not determine how the Lord feels about us. We know that both Job and Paul, through their trials, were shown this. In verse 2, this is what we are told. Whether it be love or hatred, man knoweth it not. All is before them. So summarizing this, whether man observes Yahweh's commandments or whether he ignores them, the final outcome was the same. One event happened to them all. They all go to the dead. In verse 3, we are told, this is an evil among all things. And if you literally look up the word, it really means above all things. And that greatest evil of all is the heart of the sons of man is full of evil. Or rather, full of unfulfilled desire. Man's sorrow is greatly increased by his frustration that he experienced resulting from not having any control over the things in his life. We are told madness is in their hearts. And that word madness comes from the Hebrew word hololot, from the root word hehal, implying a state when one is blind to the true issues. Men are blind to the most vital issues of life. Our understanding comes from our experiences. And since our experiences are very brief compared to Yahweh, our understanding is very limited. While we live, we seek after unattainable goals and pursue vain ambitions, but our efforts end in death. Death is the one certain and common end to all flesh, whether good or evil, just or unjust. We have inherited Adam's condemnation, and no matter what we do, we all come to the same end. In verse 4, we are told, a living dog is better than a dead lion. The living has this advantage over the dead. He can hope. He can enjoy life. And he can know happiness. This the dead cannot do. So that even a dog, not like some of our dogs who are pampered, but the dog in that time, the scavenger, is better off than a dead mighty lion, the symbol of kingly power. Solomon saw the dead robs the lion of his power and majesty and reduces him to a level below that of a living dog, to a state of nothingness. Symbolically, the Lord Jesus used the dog to stand for the Gentiles. When the woman of Canaan showed her great faith, we read of this in Matthew 15. Then came she and worshipped him, saying, Lord, help me. But he answered and said, is it not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs? And she said, truth, Lord, yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from the master's table. So if a dog stands for the Gentiles, well, what would the lion stand for? The lion may stand, he in this case would have to stand for the Jews. And we know that the Gentiles who live the truth is better than the Israelites who doesn't know or obey God. In verse 5 and 6, we are told, for the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more a reward. For the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a proportion forever in anything that is done under the sun. We were given a very good lecture on Monday about this principle in our lives. Now this is a vital principle, the first principle, and that we must understand this. Yet so many in the world really don't understand this plain basic fact. The living have a great advantage over the dead. They know. They have a conscious recognition of reality of death. The dead have not, for declares Solomon, the dead know not anything. The power to think, to reason, to discern is perished forever. For the living has this blessed gift of consciousness. He can at least know that he will die, and can pattern his life in the light of the Scriptures. The dead have nothing and can gain nothing. They do not even live in others' man's memories. The motives and passions of life, of which love and hatred and envy have all now come to an end, and no longer can they have any part in the activities of men upon earth. Many attempts are made to soften the force of these words, and it must be recognized that their primary aim is to show the effect of death as it is seen by men. All men's concerns are cut off as though they were by the cutting of a knife. But the point is made contrasting the living state with the complete end of consciousness. The complete termination of everything life has to offer. The reason that a man has no more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun is not merely that he appears to be dead, but that he is dead. The reason that a living dog is better than a dead lion is that Death totally ends everything that life is. The living know and must, and we must reject any explanation by some sophisticated interpretation of the plain truth that the dead know not anything. There's also a spiritual application that the living could stand for those who understand Yahweh's word, and they know that they will die. Those who do not know His word would be the other, and they do not understand this basic scriptural truth. They still cling to the lie of the serpent who said, Thou shalt not surely die, by believing in the immortality of the soul. In verses 7 through 10, Yahweh focuses on the living, those who have come into covenant relationship with Him. He says, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy. Solomon has recorded his beliefs on the state of the dead, who perish and pass into eternal unconsciousness in the grave. This is a depressing fact, but he quickly provides a solution. Though death is the destiny of all flesh, yet man should not be hopeless, worrying over what he cannot change. Rather, he should exact what joy he can from life in the blessings received. Bread, wine, joy, ointment, garments, and wife. God has given these things to man that he might have some measure of happiness within life's sorrow and vexation. Though he is referring to the natural life of man outside of Yahweh's purpose of redemption, Solomon also seems to have in mind the spiritual significance of these things as symbols, that we might have hope of future lasting joy in Yahweh's eternal kingdom. Thus is the face of certain death. He urges us to seek Yahweh while we can. At the end of these verses we read, for Yahweh now accepteth thy works. Enjoy life's simple pleasures, for so Yahweh hath ordained it. Since the good things of life have been established as part of the order of nature, Yahweh has shown that their use is not unacceptable to Him so long as He is remembered as the giver. In verse 8, Yahweh tells us that we also have a responsibility to conform our lives to His requirements. We must keep our garments white and our head anointed. In other words, we must fill our minds with Yahweh's words and always follow His commandments. We are told in Revelations that he that overcometh, the same shall be clothed with white raiment. So even though our goal must be keeping our garments white, we must have help. Revelation again tells us that to make them white, we must wash them in the blood of the Lamb. In other words, without learning Yahweh's word and putting on His Son's name through baptism, we cannot be saved from this body of death. In verse 9, we are told, live joyfully with thy wife. Choose a virtuous woman and rejoice in the good things Yahweh has provided. The union of male and female is ordained by Yahweh and is the symbol of God's eternal purpose with the earth and man upon it. His desire that man should become one with Him. In verse 10, we are told, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy mind. Solomon advises that man should choose the right work and opportunity to accomplish anything. Should choose the right work, and having made the choice, enter into it with zeal and enthusiasm, for life is temporary, and opportunity to accomplish anything worthwhile soon passes. For there is no work in Sheol. Yahweh again presses upon our mind that our only time to do the things that please Him is now, while we are living. the time is very brief. And once it is over, we cannot change anything that we have or have not done. In the grave, we are unconscious and we wait until the Lord Jesus returns to the earth to judge the responsible. Moving on to verses 11 and 12, we are told, "The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong." Swift, strong, and skill are words which describe the wise and gifted of the human race. Solomon explains that the ones who should succeed over others are not always the ones who are successful. Fitting rewards are not always received by those who truly should excel, for both wise and foolish are subject to time and chance. Most of you know that I have coached cross country and running, and at one time I had two of the best runners around, and at about the halfway point they were way ahead of the field, and I really felt like there was no way they could lose. And the next time I saw them, they were probably about 10th to 15th place, and I'm going, what happened? And what had happened is they took a wrong turn, and they were so far behind the field. And that just shows how time and chance happen to us all. By the way, this morning we didn't put the wrong sign for Jesse to go the wrong way, and he time and chance didn't happen to him. Fitting rewards are not always received by those who truly should excel, for both wise and foolish are subject to time and chance. Verse 12, "For man also knoweth not his time." Man does not know when death may overtake him. No one can foretell his future. James 4:13-15, "Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live or do this or that." Verses 13 through 18, we finish up the chapter with a parable of wisdom. "This wisdom seemeth great unto me." The wisdom of the parable was probably brought out from an actual experience in life. Studying the circumstances of the king who besieged the city and the poor wise man who delivered it by his wisdom, Solomon found that he could discover all the facts but one. The one fact he couldn't was the name of that poor, wise deliverer. Nobody had been interested enough to remember it. Solomon was amazed that wisdom such as this was shown by the poor, wise man should be unrewarded and unappreciated through others, though others had greatly benefited from it. Man will frequently honor and praise the foolish rich, while often despising the poor. Yahweh has chosen the poor in faith, truly wise, to glorify His name and His great and glorious name. And it doesn't matter as long as Yahweh remembers us. It doesn't matter if man remembers us or not. The words of the wise are heard in quiet in verse 17. Men pay more attention to words that of truth quietly spoken than to the loud noise of rulers among fools. It was Jesus' habit to draw his disciples away from the noise and commotion that he might quietly speak to them of Yahweh's glory and kingdom. We had an example in Matthew 5, verses 1 and 2, "And seeing the multitude, he went up into the mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto them, and he opened his mouth and taught them." Verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war. Weapons of war are made to destroy life and property, whereas wisdom turns aside anger and brings life and peace. The weapons of faith achieve more than the fleshly weapons of the flesh. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Ephesians 6 and 11. The last part of this verse is a warning. It says, one sinner destroyeth much good. The word sinner here is not like we're all sinners. The word sinner here means or signifies one who misses the mark, who goes astray. We're told the same thing in 2 Timothy 2, verses 16 through 18. But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness. And their word will eat as doth a canker, of whom is Hermanes and Philetus, who concerning the truth have erred, saying that the resurrection is past already, and overthrow the faith of some. This has been the sad history of the truth. Just think, if it was possible to happen in the apostles' days, how much more can it happen in our day? We live in the last evil days of mankind, when the question posed by Jesus, nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? We must be ever on guard to study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth.